The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, a very, very good morning to you. How are you?
Boker Tov. The question is, do we have a new era in the Middle East this morning after the peace agreements were signed yesterday?
Well, certainly I want to think so. I think it is absolutely, absolutely astounding. It is something that, please God, we will never go back from, because once this happens, it is everything, I believe, is about to change in a good way.
Well, yeah, I mean, I certainly hope so. I mean, you know, we can go through the events of yesterday. I watched the ceremony at the White House. It looked to me like actually three agreements were signed, not only two. I mean, there were two specific agreements, one between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, one between Israel and Bahrain. But it seemed that after those two separate agreements were signed, there was a third set of documents that was produced for all of the four participants to sign: the United States, Israel, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates. I'm not quite sure what that was all about, but certainly quite a show at the White House yesterday. No masks on the official delegation at all. There were some evidence in the crowd, but really not much masking up going on. There was social distancing, no hugging and shaking hands, and none of that kind of stuff went on. So it was slightly different, but certainly a significant moment. And of course, the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip did not lose the opportunity, and they were firing missiles while we were watching the peace ceremony. The TV screen was split in half.
I feel like they need to employ a new PR company.
Yeah, I mean, the screen was split in half.
I think the old one's not working for them anymore. Sorry, you were saying, Anthony?
Yeah, I said the screen was split in half. Half the screen was showing the White House ceremony where they were signing the agreements. The other half of the screen was showing missiles being fired from Gaza in real time, live update. And there were two missiles that were fired during the peace signing ceremony itself. Unfortunately, one did have a direct hit in Ashdod. There were people who were wounded, one quite seriously. 13 people, I think, all in all, were wounded. The other missile was intercepted by Iron Dome. And in fact, there was another barrage of rockets in the early hours of this morning. 13 launches, I think, all in all, 8 of which were intercepted. Fortunately, this morning, there were no reports of casualties or any damage. And of course, the IDF responded. So we'd had a tit-for-tat situation whereby the Israeli Air Force was active over the Gaza Strip last night in order to retaliate against those missiles that were fired. But it cannot take away the significance of what was going on the other half of the screen in the White House, at the White House, outside of the White House, where, you know, I think that this certainly does herald a new era. I think it does create a certain change in what's been happening up until now. And I've been asking myself some questions about what this means. I mean, the obvious things are, you know, the cooperation between the two countries, the tourism, the friendships, the business relationships that will go on between the two countries times two. In other words, between Israel and Bahrain, and between Israel and Dubai, and potentially between the three, because obviously Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates are very closely linked, both physically and in terms of economic activity. So it seems logical that there will be a lot of cooperation. But I just wonder whether this is the absolute end of the so-called Arab-Israel conflict as we know it. I mean, does this really kill that whole notion off
now?
The conflict is over.
I genuinely think it does, because it's now no longer a Arab-Israel conflict, but maybe it's a Iran-Palestinian Israel conflict, which is a very, very different state of affairs. And we were talking a little bit earlier that it's interesting that the South African media have completely ghosted the story. It doesn't exist on South African media, and it's a massive story, of course. And I think to some extent that whether they like it or not, this is going to change everything, because the part of the reason I believe that they're not reporting on it is because they don't know how. They've been schooled in a certain way of reporting when it comes to Israel, and now, and Donald Trump. You put them both together, and it is a very, very confusing story for them to have to report. That's why I think it's problematic. But whether they like it or not, they're going to have to catch up, and things will change.
It's interesting for me to have a look and see where the Arab-Israel conflict actually originated from. And if we go back to 1948, when all of those Arab countries declared war on the State of Israel, and we break down which Arab countries were actually involved in that declaration of war, including, of course, Egypt and Jordan and Syria and Lebanon, right on Israel's borders, but from further afield, Iraq and Saudi Arabia and other countries supporting from the background. If we now take out Jordan and we take out Egypt, both of which have peace agreements with Israel, the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, I think, were less part of the so-called Arab group as we understood it then. But certainly Iraq, which is really not a player anymore, and even though it doesn't have formal diplomatic relations with Israel, I don't think there is a really any conflict to speak of in any significant way with Iraq. Saudi Arabia, we are led to believe, is one of those seven or eight countries that President Trump spoke about who are waiting in line to sign agreements with Israel. Seven or eight countries, that's what he said yesterday, which really surprised me. I mean, I would have said two or three, I could understand. Seven or eight, I'm not quite sure which seven or eight he's talking about, but, you know, we could speculate. So certainly if Saudi Arabia signs an agreement, which we understand is imminent, I think that certainly would really put an end to any notion that there is a thing called the Arab-Israeli conflict. I think it's gone. I think it's history. I think we're almost over it, and certainly an agreement with Saudi Arabia would kill it off. I do agree that it's very, very difficult for many countries and many naysayers to try to report this in a way that supports their long-held position on Israel, on Israel's position in the Middle East, on Donald Trump's abilities to be a diplomat. You know, I do agree that it's enormously difficult. But have a look at the Arab Emirates. We've only signed the agreement with them yesterday. The textbooks in their schools, as of last week, are already talking about the peace with Israel. Okay?
Wow.
That's
wow.
The difference between educating your children in a positive way and raising them to be positive about the future, and the way, unfortunately, where we see other countries educating their children. So I think that this is really a momentous occasion. And I agree. I mean, there are some people in Israel who don't know how to swallow this, because on the one hand, they really do wish to feel positive about it, but there is a lot of negative feeling towards the prime minister himself for other reasons. And so a lot of people are struggling to give any credit to him or to view him in a positive light, in spite of the fact that it's undeniable that this is definitely a massive occasion. And now the question is, does this help to accelerate the establishment of a Palestinian state, or does it do exactly the opposite? And I don't know the answer to that right now. I'm giving it a lot of thought, but I think it definitely has an impact somewhere on that process, both because the Palestinians understand that their situation in the Arab world is different than it was before, and their position in the world is different than it was 2 days ago, but also because these agreements set something of a precedent. And if indeed it's true that there are seven or eight countries lining up to sign, then anybody who doesn't sign will effectively be outside of the main group.
Unbelievable. What is equally unbelievable is the state of affairs in terms of Israel's and COVID-19. I just see a breaking news story that schools are closing as of Thursday because of COVID-19. What are the latest regulations? What is going to be happening now in Israel?
Well, the schools were always down to be closed over the 3 week lockdown period, which has been formally announced. And in fairness, out of that 3 week period, 1 week the schools were due to be closed anyway for Chol HaMoed Sukkot. And the other 2 weeks were short school weeks with Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur interrupting the school week. So the schools, while they will be closed over those 3 weeks, are not losing as many actual school days as it might seem on the face of things. And there was a view as to whether the schools would close on Wednesday perhaps, but now it's been announced that the schools will close starting from Thursday. Of course, Friday is Erev Chag anyway, Erev Rosh Hashanah, and so it kind of doesn't really feel as if there's a lot of school time being lost. But of course, there are many other provisions, including restaurants being closed and only open to be available for delivery services, all other non-essential businesses and entertainment activities to be closed, including, I'm told, the beaches will be closed, which is quite a surprising situation. Lots and lots of complicated rules about shuls. How many entrances and how many exits and how many people and how many square meters and how it's going to be divided up in this way, shape or form. I think you have to become a mathematician and an architect in order to work out.
How many people are allowed actually in any given, or is it not limited to a number of people per gathering?
So it is limited to a number of people per gathering, but the headline is that 20 people will be allowed to gather together outdoors, mm-hmm. and 10 people or up to 10 people will be allowed to gather together indoors. Wow. Those are the headline limits. Right. However, where shuls are concerned, there are lots and lots of different complications. So what they're allowing shuls to do is to take the space that's available, because a lot of the shuls are obviously quite sizable. And if there are separate entrances, that the shul can be physically divided up into different spaces within
different
the shul.
Zones almost, right.
Each space connected to a different entrance. And then depending on how large each space is in square meterage terms, how many people will be allowed into that space. So that's the whole kind of complicated way of looking at this in order to, of course, accommodate high holy day prayers. There is concern, of course, that people should be looking at much more simply and saying, guys, it's not a great idea in general to go and try to find mathematical reasons why you want to put more people in a limited space. The idea is stay clear of each other. Don't go if necessary. Daven outdoors. There are loads and loads and loads of outdoor minyanim that have been set up over the high holy days. People meeting at 5 and 6 in the morning in order to avoid the heat of the day, shortening the services with the authority of the rabbis in order to keep just the main elements of the service included. And one of the things, by the way, that's quite fascinating for me is that even the shofar blowing, which of course is only on the second day of Rosh Hashanah this year, has been slimmed down, because apparently you're not necessarily obliged to hear 100 blasts, even though that is very traditional in our service, but 30 is the absolute minimum. And so that's what a lot of the services are now slimming down. Their shofar blowing down to 30 blasts and not the full 100 that we're accustomed to. Things like that are going on in order to try somehow to find a happy medium between doing what you want to do over Rosh Hashanah and what comes naturally to you and staying safe at the same time.
Yeah, really, really, it's just unbelievable that this is what it has come to, and it's certainly a lesson for South Africans as the situation here has improved. Israel was in a far better position than we were in just a few short weeks ago, weren't they?
Israel was in a very, very good position. Unfortunately, the situation deteriorated quite rapidly. I mean, you know, I'm sure that many books and research articles will be written about how exactly that happened and what gave rise to it. So, you know, now's probably not the time to do the post-mortem on that. But the point that other countries can learn from Israel's experience is that the situation can deteriorate very, very quickly indeed, that whatever happened in the first wave is no indication of what will happen thereafter. And this is with us to stay, at least for a certain period of time. And we need to learn how to deal with it on the move. We can't afford to keep closing things down dramatically. We need to find a way to recover our energy while the economy keeps moving. And unfortunately, Israel has been forced to close down over the Chagim. I think a lot of concern about people gathering together, but the economy is going to pay a dear price for this. That's the unfortunate part.
It is indeed. Anthony Rock, thank you as always. We'll catch you tomorrow morning at the same